The following is the final part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
We have been talking about how our presuppositions, that is to say, our basic worldview, shapes our whole perspective on life. That your view, your ultimate conclusions, whether God exists or does not, will shape your perspective. Parenthetically, there is a series beginning tonight that you'll make sure you want to see because it deals with this issue of ultimate perspective and presuppositions. Namely, it's the question of God. Armand Nicolai, who teaches a course and has done so at Harvard, comparing C.S. Lewis with Sigmund Freud to packed classes, has created a book called The Question of God, which, by the way, is a book you could give with confidence to any seeker or skeptic because it's just very, very clearly written and well done. And it also, through their letters and through their lives, reveals where those men were. And you can clearly draw your own conclusions. He just lets them speak for themselves. Well, PBS is doing a two-part series, 2 hours tonight, 2 hours next Wednesday night. I believe it starts here at 10 o'clock on the local station, local PBS. I don't know whether it's which of the PBS, you have to look it up. Is it on 8? Is it 10 o'clock? I'm going to tape it. I don't stay up that late. I'm going to tape the thing and get up early. But I want to encourage you to see that that series. And I've already ordered the DVD. Actually, if you go to their website, it's incredible. They show you, you can look at a download of the first 10 minutes of the material, and you can see it's really first rate, great stuff. So I look forward to that. But therein lies the question between Lewis and Freud of their fundamental presuppositions about life. Either God does or does not exist. It keeps coming down to that. The most fundamental question you can raise about life is whether God exists or does not. And Lewis, of course, being a theist, affirms that it is through the existence of God that he sees everything else. It is through that light that he's capable of seeing other things. And of course, Freud, being the atheist, naturalist, materialist, argued that we don't need any religion, that that's merely a projection, an infantile projection for a father image and so forth. And it's intriguing because your worldview will shape your whole perspective, and your perspective will shape your practice and your priorities, and your priorities will shape your practice. Now, I've talked about the presuppositions. I've talked a bit about the perspective. Looked last time at our priorities. What are my priorities in life? I want to end up with practice, and so we're going to conclude this series, I hope this morning, on this idea of paradigm spirituality, namely an eternal versus a temporal paradigm, a way of seeing, a way of living. So I want to move into the area of application and bring it down to the ground level. Because if you do not live it, you don't believe it. So the point that I'm saying here is, look, if your priorities shape your practice, then your practice will reveal your priorities. Would you agree with that? Yeah, your priorities shape your practice, but if you want to find out what your real priorities are, look at your practice and it'll tell you what they are. And so it's important for us to see it. So as one put it, if you don't live it, you don't believe it. That is to say, you may intellectualize it, but it hasn't gripped your life in a real sense. In speaking of practice, I thought of a couple of illustrations that I wanted to share with you. One of them is from G.K. Chesterton. I don't know how many of you have read his books, but very trenchant, insightful writer early in the 20th century. And he and several other literary figures were once asked what book they would prefer to have with them if they were stranded on a desert isle. How many of you heard that kind of question before? Have you ever wondered what your answer would be? Well, one of them, one writer, without hesitation, said the complete works of Shakespeare. Another said, I'd choose the Bible. How about you, they asked Chesterton. He says, I would choose Thomas's Guide to Practical Shipbuilding. I It's quite a difference, isn't it? In other words, let's get away from the ethereal. Let's get down to practice. That's the real issue here. You know, people can be great armchair theologians and theorists, but we've got to learn to become practitioners. It's like the guy whose wife said, "You're going to carve this turkey this time at Thanksgiving." And so he got a guidebook, you know, and he got the implements, and he was preparing to do this, and he really thought he had it down. Then the turkey was there, and there were no dotted lines on it. You see, the problem here is it was all theoretical. It's like learning the game of golf from a book and then think you're going to go out there and have a good swing. You know, just there are some things you can learn in your head, but there's another thing you must learn in your heart, and you apply it, and you gain skill. The disciplines, the spiritual disciplines, are designed to give us skill, training. Whenever you train, and we all can understand this, it's the knowledge of any area. You want to learn a language? You want to learn to be more skillful in a sport? Anything. What does it require? You got to practice, and that practice is training, and training habituates. So the real issue here is moving from practice to habit. And the way you go from practice to habit is by putting yourself under the discipline that at first may not seem enjoyable, but after a while, you begin to habituate it. It becomes, as it were, second nature. You see the concept there? And just as it's true in the physical realm, whether you're going to learn an instrument, I know a lot of people, or some guys I know who have, they picked up the piano, started the piano, practicing that for the first time in their lives in their 50s. I mean, you know, it's never too late, I guess. But, you know, I, as I've often thought, would love to be able to pick up an instrument like that, the piano, the violin, the guitar that I've heard, you know, like I'm listening right now to Christopher Parkening, who's a wonderful concert guitarist and committed Christian, by the way. And I hear that. You know what you do. I imagine I'm playing the thing. You know, this just we're all egotists, and we always put ourselves in the center and imagine we're impressing our friends. Maybe I'm the only one. Maybe I shouldn't have shared that. I don't believe I would have shared that. But the fact is that we imagine, wouldn't it be wonderful just to pick up an instrument and have the freedom to play and make it sing like that? I would love to be able to do that. Problem is, though, I'm not willing to pay the price. That's what it comes down to, because you have to decide how much. What do you want? And then, secondly, what's the price? And then, third, are you willing to pay it? You see, I'm not willing to pay the price because it would mean that whatever I spent on that would take away from other things, and I can't do them all. So everything has to be decided. But we are called to make decisions and to create habits that are, in fact, pleasing to God. There's an SMU. Law professor that Howie Hendricks once met, and he was very impressed with his teaching skills. And Hendricks asked him, "What is your educational philosophy?" The law professor said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I have only one principle of teaching, and that is I would rather have my students lose in here and win out there than win here and lose out there." It's rather good, isn't it? Rather good, because what he's saying is, here's the place where you have to develop the skills that really do apply, quote, out there. And in a way, what we're trying to do here is to live here for the out there. That is to say, this group of men, we gather together to encourage one another, edify, and gain perspective of how we can put this into shoe leather, how we can apply it. How many of you remember the old Southern preacher Vance Havner? He had a way with words. Isn't that an interesting thing? This guy was so incredibly well-known, so popular in the 50s and 60s. Now, none of you have heard of him at all. It amazes me. You've heard the name, you know. Boy, fame is fleeting, isn't it? I mean, the most famous person that there is, I don't care if it's a rock star or whatever, will be in a future generation the name for a future edition of Trivial Pursuit. Oh, that's not fair. No one's heard of him. Will be what the answer will be. In any case, Havner had a way with expressions, and he said too many Christians, see, kind of a folksy style back in the 50s, he said too many Christians come to church on Sunday to rest at ease in Zion, and across their faces one seems to see, as upon hotel room doors, please do not disturb. It is. He goes on to say, it's not enough to be orthodox. We must awaken to action. We have more apologists than apostles. Too many Christians are sound asleep. Our theology needs to go up in doxology. You see, that's a great phrase there. We have the facts, but not the fire. If we had as much vitality as we have had vocality, we would have set the world on fire long ago. We have talked much further along than we have walked. We need to let our feet catch up with our tongues. We defend the truth, but we do not demonstrate the truth. We ponder it instead of proving it. We preach a dynamite gospel and live firecracker lives. Now, that's the line that I like a lot. Isn't that a great line there? We preach a dynamite gospel and live firecracker lives. The guy had a way with images, didn't he? I'm thinking about the fact that there is something about us that somehow causes us to resist applying it in the rough and tumble and the nitty-gritty of everyday life. And that's where I want to move into this area of practice a little bit more. We've talked about it before. Sometimes it's a sort of an otherworldly approach that people take to the faith, that it's almost like an aristocratic thing. It shouldn't be expected to deal with the ordinary and the commonplace. Brennan Manning in Lion and Lamb describes this story of a Christian scholar. And he saw two Christian missionaries many years ago playing tennis. So they were missionaries in China, and he sees them playing tennis, never saw the game before. And this Chinese scholar could not understand why two men would play with such intensity as to perspire in the hot sun. Couldn't figure it out. So when the two missionaries proceeded to change sides, he asked him if it would not be possible to hire some coolies to play the game for him. You get the idea? Why are you working so hard? Let's get someone to do that for you. I think that's an interesting point, you know? Hire somebody. Wouldn't it be an amazing world if you could hire someone to pray for you, do your prayers for you, and the more they pray, the more spiritually you grow? It'd be a bizarre world to hire people to pump up, and then your body's the one that benefits. Very, a very strange world. The wealthy would all be Schwarzeneggers, you know. It's an interesting world there. But, you know, you cannot live by proxy, can you? You cannot live by another man's faith. At the end of the day, it's got to become your own. You're going to have this experience with your children, as I did with Heather, that God has no grandchildren. The idea here is that he only has children. There comes a point where each child, you may raise that child in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, but there comes a time when it has to become their own. They have to internalize it or reject it. Heather's experience of that was when we were living in England. She was we went there when she was 13, and we were there 2 years, and so she came back at 15. We brought her to England kicking and screaming. And she said, I'll never speak that accent. Within a year, you couldn't tell her from her friends, including not just the accent, but her expressions. She had a job in downtown Oxford in a shoe store on Saturdays, and no one would believe that she was from America. Maybe from New Zealand or something like that, but can't be from America, because she'd so absorbed the culture, and she's so well related to her friends, that by the time we wanted to come back, we had to drag her back kicking and screaming. That was the problem there. My only regret there is I didn't record her voice during that time, because she lost the accent after a few months. But in any case, because it wasn't something she'd learned all her life. But the interesting thing is that was the years where she had to decide, do I believe this, or is it just something I'm picking up from my parents? Is it just by proxy, or do I internalize it? Every person has to come to the point where they own it or reject it. That's really what goes on here. Some of us have children who have, for one reason or another, resisted or rejected. And all we can do in that context is to pray for them and to love them, not beat them over the head, because there comes a point where it's counterproductive to try to work them over and cajole them and push them. And if they know your position, the way you have to do it is to love them, to serve them, to pray for them, and to be there for them when they have need. And really, that's what it comes down to in the end. But the point is that it's got to come down into practice. And it needs to be something that we internalize. Heather's friends in England were virtually all atheists. I mean, it's a very, very secular, it's far more secularized than our country has come. We are moving that way, but nothing like that. There was no place for God at all. And it was only by virtue of a couple of influences in her life that she really was able to see the real thing. Part of her problem, you see, was that she has an incredible discernment and she can pick up hypocrisy a mile away. And she could see when people were being authentic and when they were not. And frankly, she saw a lot of inauthentic behavior in so-called Christians that really disturbed her. Thanks be to God, there was a guy, Kenny Wilson was his name, who was a youth worker in her school, the Cheney School there in Headington in Oxford. And this guy was working with her and her friends and so forth and had a huge impact. And the thing that really gave him credibility was that she saw he was the real deal. That was what made the difference. She could perceive in him there is no guile. There is no manipulative stratagems. And so at the end of our time in England, she decided this really was true, and she embraced it. And so she came back. By the way, when she came back, it was culture shock. She was amazed at the shallowness of American teenagers. That's another story. But in any case, because having been in another culture, there's something about this faith that requires application. You've all heard the phrase, revelation demands a response, haven't you? The idea that revelation must be pursued by in application. The Bible was not merely written to inform us, but to transform us. Nice phrases, but what do they look like? How are we transformed? How do we bring it down to the day by day? Now, I have a whole session I'm going to teach you soon on process spirituality that deals just with that. How do we incorporate this faith in the process of everyday living? And I'm going to develop that soon. But in the meanwhile, I want to read this little quote that I read from Tim Hansel's book, When I Relax, I Feel Guilty. How many of you read that little book? When I Relax, I Feel Guilty. Bic, you read it. What did you think of that book? Fabulous, wasn't it? Yeah, I can't too highly recommend it for guys who are really suffering from workaholism and from a lack of margin and a lack of perspective. It's When I Relax, I Feel Guilty, Tim Hansel. And he just it's just replete with really practical issues and implications from a guy himself who had been in that trap. Listen to what he calls almost Christianity. Intriguing. He says, almost Christianity will reveal itself in countless subtle ways. I know many who claim that with Christ, all things are possible except to help them lose weight. I know those who extol the benefits of quiet time but don't have enough time for contemplation themselves. Others lecture on the resurrection and try to do everything on their own power. Isn't that a good point? They talk about the resurrection, but then they try to live in their own power, not the power of the resurrected Christ. I know people give sermons on the Lordship of Christ, but who can't slow down because they think the world would collapse without their activities. Some people applaud the security we have in Christ, but are unwilling to take any chances. A very good insight, because you do not grow apart from taking risks. You will not grow in this faith without taking chances and taking risks, because everything he calls us to do will be countercultural. So it is a risk-taking venture. He goes on and concludes, and still others glorify the freedom that is ours, but are still enslaved to their work. And so Hansel offers some extremely livable and practical suggestions. Let me share with you the story of a man that I knew, not well, but I knew him. I met him in the 80s. And in June 1986, this fellow by the name of Mark Pett shared these words with me, and I basically wrote them down because I visited with him, and I thought the man had incredible wisdom. Here's what he said. He says, we have a clear sense of birth, but a theoretical sense of death. Interesting way of putting it, isn't it? Understand that you have a certain number of days. There is no good time to die. You don't retire from life and get ready for death. When you leave this planet, you will never again have the privilege of sharing the gospel. Ever think of that? Never again will you be able to do that. Serving the lost, feeding the poor. This is not a guilt trip, but a reminder to enjoy the opportunity and privilege of representing Christ to the world. This proceeds out of love. And this is an important insight. He says, the love you give back to him drives the opportunities you have. Very important that. We must not wait to get to heaven, but relish the only opportunities we will have. I thought that was very wise. I saw him again. That was in June of 86. I saw him a second time in March of 87. And among other things, I recorded these words. He said this, "I'm trying to come to grips on a daily basis with what it means to seek first his kingdom. Part of this means not pursuing what our system rewards. There's a problem of drifting back into complacency. God has not promised me tomorrow. There are things to accomplish on this side, and it takes a measure of faith to believe that there is something on the other side." Now, the person who said this was suffering from terminal cancer. He was given only about 6 months to live. He actually lived 3 years. He had bone cancer. I think he was about 6'2". By the time I saw him, he was about 5'8". His body was just basically crumbling. He couldn't go downstairs without great agony. So when I saw him, I saw, here's a guy my exact same age, pastor of a church, but he outstripped me in wisdom because of the pain that he suffered. You see, so he had this, that's why I said, these are words I got to record. And I dated them. And so what I saw here is that his vocational ministry was something that was transformed by this new dimension in his life. He gained this wisdom through pain, and he went to be with the Lord not long after that, in February 1988. And he stressed the privilege of practice and the window of opportunity to make a difference during our earthly sojourn. Larry Moody, I used to work with Search Ministries, and Larry Moody is still a friend of mine, and he and I visited Mark. And Larry gave Mark's funeral. Among the other things he said this, "If you would ask me when I first met Mark what he was like, I would have said he was a gifted man. But in the last 3 years, if you asked me what I said he would say he was like, I would say he was a godly man." Catch the difference? It's one thing to minister out of your gift and out of your knowledge base. It's another thing to minister out of your experience, your pain, your need, and your dependence upon God. And that is really where it comes down to. So here's a guy saying, we have a clear sense of birth, but a theoretical sense of death. He knows whereof he speaks. He's wrestling with the issue that we don't have. The fact is, though, people he knew probably died before he did. There's never any assurance of how long you'll be on the planet. God may give us a reprieve for a period of time. Regard that as a gift. Regard it as an opportunity to continue in this world, because he's right. You know, there's a lot of things you're going to be able to do better in heaven than you can do on earth. What are things you're going to be able to do better in heaven than you can do on earth? Give me some examples. Worship will be a lot better in heaven. You know, sometimes what we call worship is just banal, but that's another story. Worship will be a good deal better. We'd all agree with that. What else can we do better in heaven than we do on earth? Creativity will be extraordinary. You haven't seen anything yet. Your capacity, your mind, your time, all that will be something totally different. Your experience will be radical. That's why some of you have heard me say, I like one way of defining heaven is endless creative activity without frustration to the glory of God. Creativity will be a completely new story. What else can you do better in heaven than you can do on earth?
Some of us sing.
Some of us is a good point here. The fact is, I don't care how well we sing, it'll be better. Music will be better. I remember having a discussion in Malaysia with Oz Guinness about this very issue, and I said, you know, my concern here is that when we get to heaven, somebody's taste in music has to change. And I said, I hope it's not mine. You know, he chuckled at that, but then suddenly the answer dawned on me. You know what it was? Everybody's taste will change. Everybody's. The difference between bebop and Bach will be as nothing, because the real reality, you haven't heard anything yet. And so our tastes will all have to be changed to become accustomed to that, those melodies, to that richness. You'll need the resurrected body to experience that. All right, so we mentioned what things so far? We mentioned worship. We mentioned singing. We mentioned creativity. What was the other one? Was there any other?
What about sensitivity and sincerity?
What's that? Sensitivity and sincerity? I think that certainly in heaven we'll be able to do that. Relationships, let's be honest about it, relationships will be unimpeded by selfishness and unimpeded by hidden agendas and unimpeded by manipulation. All that will be greatly enhanced. So relationships will be far more sincere, more real. In fact, there will not be any guile at all, no flaw, no nothing, because the best of you will remain. All right, what else will we be able to do? Love, no question about it. Our capacity to love will be immeasurably greater than it is now.
How about personal disciplines?
You know, it's an interesting thought. One doesn't associate personal disciplines with the resurrected body, but my suspicion is that what we call discipline on earth will be our pleasure in heaven. In other words, prayer and talking to God, in other words, and all that. How about reading the Bible, studying the Bible? Well, frankly, you won't need it, you see. Although my suspicion is we'll have access to it and be able to see, how did I miss it? It was there all along, you see. It'll be filled with things, with thousands of things you never can see now. And so a lot of people will have flat foreheads going in heaven saying, how did I miss it? How did I miss it? And like that. Because but it was obvious, but it wasn't obvious, you see. I suspect some of the things Jesus said on the road to Emmaus when he was describing the things spoken to him in the law and in the prophets probably had some stuff in there that you'd be surprised about. Okay, so the word will be better. Prayer will be a great deal better, because it'll be unmediated and direct. Then you will not see by faith, but then by sight. All right? Let me stop there and consider this. There are two things, though, in heaven that you'll never be able to do that you can do on earth. And this is, as I said, sharing the good news with those who do not have it and serving people who are in need. That opportunity will never have again. So therefore, we would do well to treasure the opportunity that we enjoy in this world and to make the most of the opportunities, because the days are short. And so my view is this: all of us can be involved in sharing the good news by the very nature of our lives and our witness, and by our integrity and by our work and by our diligence to do things well. And that your faith becomes evident. What was it St. Francis said? That you should always preach the gospel, and if necessary, do it with words. You see what he's saying there? That much of your time, I'm not advocating that you go to the office and you bring a big black Bible and you put it on your desk and thump people as they come in, you know. Clobbering them into the kingdom is not the way to do it, you know. but you'll thank me now, hate me now, but thank me later. No, that's not how it works. I'm talking about something better than that. I'm talking about a quality of integrity, of character, and of excellence in your work that speaks for itself. And where people know where you're coming from, but you don't have to be preachy or pushy or manipulative, because you trust in the sovereign work of God. But I believe God's given you opportunities, and he's given you an arena of influence to accomplish just that. So that's why I say, if our priorities shape our practice, then our practice will reveal our priorities. And if it doesn't include things along these lines of where we want to begin to get to know God and spend some time in Scripture, time talking with him, time in reflection, time of being, in other words, being time, then there's something wrong with our priorities, because they're not going to be in alignment with those of Scripture. So I believe that we have been given opportunities, and they'll be reflected in the way we love one another, the way we serve each other, the way we spend our time, and so forth. There are two one-liners that my friend Bill Garrison in Fort Worth, Texas, gave me that I'll never forget. The first one-liner was this. It always challenges me. He said this: write your obituary now and see if it will play well in heaven. Isn't that a great line? Write it now and see if it'll play well in heaven. Hey, it may play well in Peoria, but what about in heaven? The second line that he gave me was this: what are you taking under your arm to the ultimate show and tell? You see, because there will be a show and tell. That's called the judgment seat of Christ, the Bema. It is not a judgment of condemnation, but one of rewards. But nevertheless, we will give an account for ourselves. So we would do well then to live with that in mind. I'll close with a few verses, one from John 9, one from Galatians 6, one from Colossians 4, and one from Ephesians 5. I want you to hear them in connection with one another, because they tie so well together. Jesus said, "We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people. Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time because the days are evil. This is why your presuppositions will shape your perspective. Your perspective will shape your priorities, and your priorities will shape your practice. Any closing thoughts or comments? I have a couple minutes. Those verses I'll give you exactly are these. John 9:4 was the first verse. Then Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, the first half of that verse. The third verse was Colossians 4, 5. I thought these four went well together. That's why I wanted to read them that way. Colossians 4, 5. And the last one was Ephesians 5, verses 15 and 16. And reading them together, there's something about them, how they all underscore a powerful theme. So this just gives me a reminder that you are to be, that there's an urgency without anxiety. You see the difference there? There is a sense of urgency, but without biting your fingernail. That God's given you, and I believe this is true, He's given you just enough time on this planet to accomplish His purposes in your life. He's given you enough time to do it, no, neither more nor less. And I want to tell you, as I'm a true believer in desert time. I'm teaching Romans on Monday night upstairs, 7:30, and you're welcome to come. But I was talking about Paul's preparation for his ministry, and he went through a lot of years of desert time. That is to say, when he was not being used by God, God had to prep him, took him away. Jesus, how many years did he spend relative to his public ministry? Moses. How many years? He thought he'd be Israel's deliverer at the age of 40, right? Turned out 40 years in the desert before he was ready, till he was 80. I want to suggest that we all go through times of preparation, and for many of us here in this room, your last years, I think, may well be the key years of your life, that everything's led up to these last years, and that all your experience and your education, your knowledge, your background, your relationships could, in fact, be converging now in such a way that you want to finish well and you want to use all that God's given you in the time you have left in order to accomplish just that. Urgency without anxiety. Any other any closing? Yes, Dennis.
This question of God by Nikolai.
Yes.
You mentioned something about a DVD.
Yes.
Yes,
when you go to the PBS site, and actually there's a link. If you got my email, if you didn't send me an email, and I'll give you the link to their PBS site specifically to that, you can go there and you can pre-order the DVD. It'll be on back order. Do you have the site here? Why don't you read it? It's going to be, let me see. Yeah, it's... I have it here. You can just write it down because www.pbs.org, WGBH, / question of God. Just write it down from here. It's just a bit much. It's a bit much.
Is this something you can give to your kids who will help them see?
I'm promising you that.
Share
absolutely. And you're going to see his discussion with Harvard students. And you're going to see some of them are atheists and materialists, and some are believers, and he mixes it up with them. This is something you can give with great confidence. So I saw it was so good when I saw one of the previews. We'll try this DVD then. It could be very effective. You know the other DVD idea I mentioned, and you've heard me do it before. Some of you are now seeing it, The Blue Planet. And the reason why I give that to people is because that is pre-evangelism. It's going to give people a sense of amazement and wonder. And if they have any real discernment at all, they'll know this just didn't happen.
What is it called?
The Blue Planet BBC series. There are four DVDs. It comes in one package. You can buy it on Amazon for $41. And I'm telling you, I've seen them all eight. There are two on each. I've seen all eight, and I'm planning to see them all again. For me and Karen, it was all worship. Just seeing that. Just couldn't believe it. Who would invent this stuff? You couldn't, I promise you, even all that you know, if I got you in this room, locked you up for a month, you wouldn't be able to come up with one creature as clever as the millions that are on this planet. You wouldn't be able to do it. Forget the engineering. I just talk about the outward design. You couldn't do it. It's just boggling. So I think those would be another resource. That would be more subtle, but that would be good too. So both of those are excellent.
Sounds like start with the Blue Planet.
I'd start with the Blue Planet. Then I'd nail him with that. That's the way to manipulate him. The old 1-2 punch.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.